somehow through all this technical turmoil. I mean, Gabigan, better known as Thesis Whisperer, and our own friends encouraged us to start this podcast, didn't they, Jason?
They did indeed.
And they encouraged us because they reckon both of us are pretty good at handling the stress of academic work. And I guess that's being a lecturer and a researcher, it's detail-oriented, time-consuming, annoyingly political, and many jobs like this. So maybe our conversations help other people doing this kind of knowledge work in other walks of life. What do you reckon?
Well, yeah, I think there's lots that we can take from the university universe, if you like, and apply it even more broadly than just in our own sector. So there's, you know, we've got some good stories to tell, I think.
I think so. Well, the real reason I wanted to start this podcast, Jason Downes, is it's my excuse to talk to you on the reg. So I'm Inga Mewburn, I'm the Director of Research Training at ANU, and I work with research students. But who are you, Jason?
I'm Jason Downes, and I'm the Director of Programs for the College of Business and Law at RMIT University.
That sounds very fancy.
I know, it's such a big title, right? Like I draw it out every now and again and say, oh, use that one because that will impress people, knowing full well that it doesn't impress anyone.
Yeah, that's why I use the word director. And then people will think, oh, she must actually direct things.
Yeah. There's action going on somewhere.
It doesn't happen really in universities. Anyway, so we thought in this podcast that we'd do things like talk about our work problems without being boring. That was an aim. Maybe some of the things we've been reading, some of the problems we've had to solve. So you classify yourself, Jason, as an advanced enthusiast. In what?
Well, I guess for me, it's so I, for my sins, right, I'm in university administration now. And that comes after 10 years as an academic, as a working academic in the school management, but also another decade or so as a property valuer. So for my sins now, I've figured out over the years that if you need to repeat something, chances are you can build a system for it. What I like to do is build systems that prevent me from having to do rework. So if I can automate something, I will. But I can't code. I don't know coding, JavaScript, all HTML. Like I can't do any of that sort of stuff. So what I like to do is take available software and then kind of push its boundaries and see if I can make it bend it to my will to get stuff done.
And what I like to do is to learn what you've done and just copy it. And then I've created this sort of famous blog over 10 years and people are like, wow, you're a genius at productivity. I'm like, Jason Downes is my productivity guru. And then people say, who is Jason Downes? So now here is Jason Downes. I'm bringing you into my world, Jason.
Oh,
well, genius can be appreciated.
Oh, thank you. Look, I like you, I'm just excited about having the opportunity to be able to talk to you on the regular.
On the reg. So, Jason, work. What was your problem at work this week? And how did you
delegation?
Delegation.
Delegation is my problem. So we'll probably talk about this a little bit more over the course of the podcast, but I rely heavily on a piece of software called OmniFocus, which is a task management software. It's for the Mac. So sorry, all the people who don't use Macs. And it, like, over the last probably 5 to 7 years, I've used this and really started to couple it with David Allen's getting things done methodology, to be able to keep track of what's going on in my life and which project I'm working on. And over the last little bit, it's become harder and harder and harder. There's more going on. And right now, things are moving so quickly. We have to shift so quickly in response to what's going on in the environment that people have been so good. They've been saying, like, Jace, can I help you with this? And I've been able to sometimes delegate some of those tasks that would be sitting with me to somebody else. They've offered to take them off my plate, which is really, really good, but I need to track them. Otherwise, you know, the cognitive load, and I would just forget who I gave what to and what stage we're up to and all that sort of stuff. So I've been using OmniFocus and using a little tag, a delegated to tag in OmniFocus. And I'll put all of the details about how this works in the show notes. But the idea here is to essentially, when I give something to someone to do or they take it off me, I put a little note in OmniFocus that says delegated to Inga Mewburn. It tags at work. It tags it your name as well. So you've got your own little tag. And that means that whenever I'm in front of you, I can just search up for your tag, and all of the things that I've tagged to you pop up on my OmniFocus list. And that's where we can have a chat about that. Remember, you were going to do the budget and I was going to get Doritos and, you know, all of that sort of stuff. And the other side of it that's really good is because it's in the name of the tag, Inga Mewburn, not the tag, in the name, the description of the task, it doesn't matter how you search in OmniFocus, you'll come up. And it's a really, really good way to kind of keep on top of things and make sure that things keep moving ahead.
I'm also an OmniFocus fan, following you, Jason, of course. And the one thing that I realised that OmniFocus does for me in a similar sort of way is that it makes me scary inside my because if I've given something to finance, for example, and I haven't heard back from finance for 3 weeks, I'm the sort of person that writes, on the 14th of April, I sent you an email that requested this, 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 and this. I expected an answer as I requested at this time, and I have not got this answer. And I've sort of find that people in a very large institution don't expect you to have memory. I think because we are all delegating, work's moving between each other, that we tend to sort of let things slide or forget, or another task comes in. And most people who are not working with some sort of task tracker are just really responsive. They're responding to everything that comes into their email box at any moment, right? So you might have slipped onto page 2 and you've got Buckley's of anyone coming back to help you out. And so therefore I have a sort of similar process in Omni. I have this thing called Nudge, and it's Nudge is just a tag. And the nudge is the people that I know that I have to nudge to remind them something or get something from them. And sometimes people come back before I nudge them. That's great. And I just sort of clean out Nudge once a week to see what's happening with the people that should be nudged. And that really helps me just be that scary person inside my institution. The other way I was scary this week, Jason, was that university is going through a tough time right now, right? Your university going through a pretty tough time?
Pretty tough times. We made the scary list.
You made the scary list. Yeah, I noticed that you made the scary list on the Larkins and Marsh scary list of universities who don't have very much money scary list. I was in the second scary list, not in the first scary list. But yeah, you made it to the top shelf scary.
And by quite the margin, actually, when you looked at that, it was like, yeah, so yeah, a fair bit of anxiousness, I think, with everybody at work at the moment.
Yeah, and this is fair enough. And the other thing that's happening is that universities are trying to claw money from behind the sofa cushions, so to speak. So all universities have lots of little funds, although ANU, to my intense surprise, apparently only has one bank account. The statements on that bank account must be mind-blowingly in the millions. Can you imagine going through your credit card statement? Like, it'd be crazy, right? But they create all these little, like, buckets of money, all these kind of accounts to move money and manage money around. And so they're just poking into all these accounts. And if you've got an account, they just send you an email and say, hey, can we have your money? And, of course, if it's money there for a grant, you're like, hey, no, you can't. That money is there for a grant. I'm sorry, I can't give it to you. So I'm going through a little bit of this process at the moment. I've got 3 of these accounts with my funding in them and so on. And I needed to get some authorization to get some money transferred out of one of those accounts. And I ended up having to try and save that request from going to a committee. I did manage to save it from going through a committee, not by saying, hell no, don't send me to a committee, which was the thought inside my head. I was like, oh, maybe we could explore the alternative of maybe consulting with the university lawyer and maybe they can let us know what we should do here. But so committees, Jason, you and I sit on committees. Maybe we've run committees in the past.
Oh, yeah.
Why is it a bad idea to let something you want to have happen go to a committee sometimes?
Well, as you rightly point out, often there's people like you and me sitting on these committees, right? And attention to the detail is probably our strong suit for you and I. And most people, when they put stuff up for committee, don't put the documentation up in a state where it's ready for a decision. And the moment that you get the documentation in front of you, and if it's not really, really good, and you start to come across errors or faults in the documentation, you just lose all confidence, right, in the whole proposal. Mm. And if you've got 8 or 10 or a dozen people sitting around a table, that can kill a really good idea really quickly. just because the documentation wasn't sound.
Yeah, nothing like a committee to kill a good idea, is there, actually? So a friend of mine has a 12 cups of coffee theory around committees, you know, that the best way to get something through a committee is actually to have met every single person on that committee separately somehow and had 12 cups of coffee in order that they trust you. So even if there is a spelling mistake or something in the document, they're not going to throw it back in your face. But that's hard in these COVID times, isn't it, to actually have coffees with people? Like, I think people underestimate the power of, you know, the coffee to smooth the way.
Yeah, we had a program come through a curriculum committee, and I can remember sitting in my office and the program manager came before we saw any of the documentation, you know, like when this thing was just an idea, came around and he had coffee with me, and I totally felt worked, if you know what I mean. Like like, bless him, he was awesome, right? But I knew I was being worked over to make sure that this thing was going to go through. And it totally worked. Like, we sat down, we talked about what the idea was. He asked me if there was anything that would concern me. I laid out where usually these things fall over and these are the things that I look for. He went away and he addressed them in the documentation so that by the time it came to us, I already felt good about the program because the program manager had come and spoken to us. But they were also my concerns were addressed in the documentation. So you're absolutely right. The 12 cups of coffee, it's so good.
Yeah, so stakeholder engagement, they call it in other areas. We just call it, you know, politics inside university. But I don't know, have you been on committees lately? I'm really enjoying this new era of the Zoom committee because it used to be that I have to hide the fact that I was kind of doing my email and not really listening. But now I just turn my camera off and my microphone off and I just carry on like I'm listening to the most boring talkback radio of all time until my item comes up or something that I actually have to pay attention to. I don't want to sound like a lax committee member, but you know, often I'm there. Sometimes I'm not even sure why I'm on a committee. Like, I get drawn into committees. And I think sometimes if you're just a person who talks a lot, I don't know, do you just get drawn on? What is it that makes people put you on committees? But as I was telling you before, I had this theory that if you're a busy person inside the university, people notice that you're busy. And so they're like, hey, they're busy. They must be good at managing their shit. I'm just going to give them my stuff as well. And you sort of end up like lint in a washing machine. Suddenly you've got this work stuck all over you and you're not quite sure how it happens. So committee work, you know, can take a lot of hours out of your week. But you're actually, your new job, like you're like, committee lord, aren't you?
Yeah. I'm in committees all over the place. But one of the things that I have been doing is tracking my time on these various committees with a timing app.
Have you?
So, you know, yeah. So preparation for committees, the invisible work of reading all the documentation beforehand before you actually get to the face-to-face meeting. Mm. And I've been tracking that and keeping an eye on it. And they do, they suck up an inordinate amount of time, which is why I get cranky when the stuff that comes to us is not in a decision-ready state.
So a friend of mine used to describe these kind of jobs as baking powder jobs. It looks like a teaspoon of work, but in fact, before you know it, your work cake is fluffed up and it's overflowing the tin, you know, baking powder job. Knowing which ones are and spotting them before you get drawn into it is a bit of a work skill. Do you have any top tips for like being an awesome committee member? You spend time, you know, aside from the kind of politicking before the committee, like, do you have a top tip on conducting yourself at a committee in a way that makes you effective?
Yeah. So the thing that I really like to do is listen to everybody else first and then kind of consolidate all of the thinking and then put forward my position or a question around that. And then at the end of the committee meeting is to wrap up, to summarize. So to bring everyone back to the purpose of the meeting and say, okay, so in summary, this is where we've got to with this particular decision and these are the next actions moving forward. And so then as soon as you've got an action list, it's, you know, off to OmniFocus and away we go again.
Yes, exactly right. It all comes around back to OmniFocus. So listeners who don't have Macs, we're sorry, buy a Mac. No, I'm only joking. sort of only joking. Nirvana app. I've heard good things.
Oh, okay.
A little bit more email integration and works on a PC. So can't verify because I haven't actually done it, but I hear good things. I'm looking at our show notes and wondering where we're at now, Jason.
I thought we were thinking about what we've been reading over the last little bit.
Oh, yeah.
And last week I was talking about a book that I was reading called Turn the Ship Around. But in the week between then and now, I want to talk about a different book. I went back to one called Remote by Jason Fried. So this is back in 2013, Jason Fried, he's the one of the founders for 37 Signals. They're the folks that make Basecamp and those kinds of pieces of
software. I'm a fan of Basecamp.
Actually. Yeah, great, right?
Can you tell us what Basecamp is? It's like a project management team app, right?
Yeah, and it's a light version of it. So you don't get all of, you don't get bogged down in, you know, Gantt charts and all the rest of it. And it's a collaboration app around projects. It's really good. But they wrote a book back in 2013 because they had a distributed work model called Remote. And he pulls apart all of the reasons why remote working can actually work really well for an organization. And I've been thinking about it in the context of the university, right? Like, I have an office. It's a nice office in the middle of the building up on Swanston Street. And every day I commute in and out for 2 hours to go to my nice little office. And I sit in there and I beaver away. And reading this book again and having worked from home now for the last 10 or 11 weeks, this idea of being able to do remote work has really shifted my thinking. And I've been trapped to think that working from home means working from my Wi-Fi. And remote reminded me that if I've got a mobile phone and a laptop, I don't need to work from my home base anymore. So Wednesday, I decided I'm going to go down to the foreshore, took my phone and my laptop, sit on one of the park benches down there, and I was going to do some work. I had some meetings that I had to go to through Teams. Everything was going well. I was like really happy about it. I had my coffee, like, you know, looking out over the water. It was all great. Living the dream. Right up until the point where Melbourne weather came in and it started to pour with rain. So there I was, 9:30 in the morning with an operations team meeting, and I'm in the front seat of my Jeep, right? Like, phones mounted on the dashboard, right? And they're all like, this is the worst Uber driver I've ever seen. Like, 2 stars. Like, where are we going now?
So many people meet me from cars because they live in share houses, right? It's the only place they have any privacy. The background does something really weird in a car because it's always in the back of the seat or something. You're like, where are you? Oh, in my car. So they're popping in and out of their car all day to have meetings, poor things. So what else does he say?
It's a good book. I recommend it. It's a light book. It's relatively short. I'm reading it on my Kindle. And it's a good one for people who want to make an argument to work from home, like not to actually have to come into the office if they don't want to.
Like, I never want to go back to the gym. I'm never going and pressing my face into some yoga mat that someone else has pressed their ass into. Like, those days are gone. Yeah. It's Liz Mills on the tally all day. So some people will be just like, why do I go into that place? Being able to actually go between here and my office and have a bit of a split life at the moment is suiting me down to the ground, I must say. Do they have any other tips in the book that are like help you work from home, or is it more of an argument for working from home?
Well, so, you know, time and a place, 2013, it was really an argument for being able to work remotely. They step you through all of the basics, right? How do you do that? How do you, as an organization, how do you set it up? How do you trust your staff that they're actually doing work so that you're not surveilling them? Yeah. And the basic premise is give them interesting work to do. If people have got interesting work, they'll do it, right? If you're giving them boring work, then chances are they are going to goof off and play Xbox or something like that.
A lot of organisations, isn't it, that maybe won't survive if they have to pay rent. A colleague of mine, Fiona Jenkins, wrote an interesting article in the Canberra Times during lockdown talking about how our employers have requisitioned our houses. So it's like during a war, you know, you take the supplies of whatever village you're going through. It's this nice word filling called requisitioning. People have had really intense chats about how they've had to upgrade their internet plan and, you know, that's cost me money. Whereas I've just paid for the biggest internet pipe that I can have access to forever because streaming, right? And also geek household with people who play online games and stuff. So I just sort of walked into this gushing fountain of internet. But some friends of mine have had to really significantly invest, and they really saying, oh, the employers are expecting me to pay for this. It's a really interesting discussions to be had, and I'm sure they'll unfold over time. You know what I've been reading, Jason?
What?
Non-obvious megatrends.
Oh, yes.
You can't see me holding up The amazing cover of this book. See how shiny it is? Silver.
I was about to say, it's silver and shiny.
It's a mega trend. And so it's by Rohit Bhargava, and it's called Non-Obvious Megatrends, How to See What Others Miss and Predict the Future. And I'm not normally a hardcover kind of girl, you know. They're nice to have, but to read, they're a bit annoying. But I could not walk past this book and not buy it. And besides, I was out at lunchtime stimulating the economy in our university bookstore. I just bought $300 worth of books in my lunchtime, which in normal times would horrify me. I was spending that much, but I'm like, the economy. Anyway, so this guy has been compiling trend reports since 2011. I had never heard of them before. So I was like, oh, that's a bit on the dodge. But I just had missed this somehow. But he's one of those people, I think he injects ideas into the collective consciousness, and you don't know they've come from him. The non-obvious megatrends is a compilation of 10 years of trend reports. So what he's done is he's taken the trends from each year and then he's compiled them and works out the megatrends. And they all really spoke to me, Jason. Like, reading this book has been a bit of a slow burn. I see the trends now. It's like that, as my therapist would say, name it to tame it. So you sort of name the trend in order to see and recognise the working of the trend. So a couple of my favourites were ungendering, which is the kind of trend towards just seeing people as people, which I think is a really positive trend, and letting people identify whatever gender they want to have. The other ones that caught my attention were human mode. So it talks about how, you know, when you go to websites and stuff and you can never get through to a person, everyone wants you to go and find what you need online, but sometimes you just can't and you just want a human. And that humans have become this sort of commodity in the information economy, that to dip into human mode is sort of a sign of wealth, which was an interesting thing. And also instant knowledge. So that idea that you can sit, you know, you can do a masterclass on writing with Stephen King and he can tell you in a couple of videos how he's an amazing writer, and you will instantly become an amazing writer as well. And I've really noticed that in our online learning, that people are really enjoying our 1 hour classes, which I think are sugar hit of learning and not really learning in my book. So what was interesting about non-obvious megatrends is also his method. So how he makes prediction is sort of mindful web surfing. So he's sort of like, if you see something and it piques your interest, then it's probably a trend. You don't know yet, just collect it. And you just collect and collect and collect. And at the end of the year, you work out what you've collected and what's caught your eye. And that's apparently a trend. I don't know if this works, but I'm always a collector. Thank you for putting me onto Pocket App, because that's an amazing aggregator. So I thought this book would be stupid. Colour me surprised when it's amazing. So non-obvious megatrends, get on it.
Does he talk about how he collects it, like the processes behind it? Like,
take
them all into a spreadsheet or...?
Yeah, he's a spreadsheet guy and he collects everything. And then he's got all these pictures of him and his team. So he really subjects it to the scrutiny. So he invites lots of people in. And you can see he's an Indian guy, right? So you can see the rest of his team are really diverse as well. And so he's really walking that walk with people who just aren't all of the same colour or age or whatever. It looks like he's got people who are much older and much younger, and they all sit around the table and they all just kind of sort out the trends. And one of the things he thinks is really important is naming the trend. So he has a good way with names, you know. So the trends are amplified identity, revivalism, human mode, attention wealth, purposeful profit. You know, so he part of his process is just finding the right name for it, which, you know, maybe we'll find the right name for this podcast, Jason. This is the creative process.
Absolutely. They're really catchy names too. Like you can hang on to them, I guess. They've got those kind of mental hooks, right? So you can identify them when you're walking around, like you were saying earlier.
Yeah. The good thing about this book is it summarises all his previous trends. So he takes every trend that he's predicted since 2011 and he rates himself on how good was I with that trend. Was it actually a thing? Or was it that I was seeing something that later became something real, but and I sort of misidentified it? So that kind of reflexive process, that sort of authenticity, seeing behind the curtain, I really appreciate that in an author who can say, hey, I kind of got it wrong at the time, but now I see that it was part of this other thing. And so, yeah, it's a really well-written book too, actually. Great editor, whoever his editor is. Speaking as a person who's been edited a few times, you can appreciate the artistry in a good edit.
Well, I'm going to have to put that one right at right at the top of my book list, I think. Sounds like high praise.
Yeah, well, we should swap books, so I should read remote, hey? So, although I am reading at the moment the new Rick Wilson book. He's a Republican who's turned Democrat. You know, he's a never-Trumper. And he wrote a great book last year called Everything That Trump Touches Dies. And now he's written a new book called Beating the Devil. And he's got a new podcast called The New Abnormal, which is my top pick for podcasts.
A little bit all over the place at the moment with my podcasts. I want to give a bit of a shout out to Narelle Lemon, Relly Pops, mutual friend of ours. Her podcast is about teachers helping teachers. So pre-service fourth year teachers are about to go out into the schools, and she gets experienced people to talk to them, and she records them as part of a podcast series. And one of the things that I've really been loving about that particular podcast is the enthusiasm of the students, right? Like, this is why we get into teaching. And you can really hear it come through in that. And I must admit, you know, it's been, you know, more than a decade in the university sectors now. There's a risk that you can become jaded around some of this stuff. And it was lovely listening to Narelle's podcast and hearing all of that enthusiasm about people who are really engaged and really looking forward to making a difference in teaching.
Yeah, I'd like to thank Narelle for encouraging us to be in a podcast, and we'll see if we can make all our technical things work, because I think I've got this one on three recorded devices now, and somehow one of them, Jason, will record. I believe in our technology. Shall I turn off the recording?
Let's do that.
Okay. Thanks, Jase.
Thanks, Inga.